Today is the 22nd of July 2009, and I'm at Kereva Park Spirituality Centre interviewing Sister Joy Belt. Joy, what's your full name?
My full name is Joy Belt.
What year were you born?
1933 in Auckland, New Zealand.
Could I ask what date you joined the convent?
I joined the convent in March 1953 in Auckland.
And that was the Sacred Heart Nuns?
Sacred Heart, Barradine Convent.
And what year did you come to us to Sydney?
I came to Sydney in January 1973.
Did you arrive at St. Therese Primary School? Like, what can you talk a bit about how you came to be at that school?
I came to be at the school because at the time our order was going through many changes, like other congregations. And in the past, we would get a message that Reverend Mother wanted you, and you would go to Reverend Mother, and she would say, God wants you in Sydney. But with these recent changes, in the November 72, I got a message that the provincial, Sister Mary Shanahan, had rung to speak to me, which in itself was unheard of. And I was at a school meeting, and would I ring her back? Well, we all wondered what she could possibly want. So it was 10 o'clock before I got back to ring her in Auckland. I was in Wellington. So I rang Mary, and she said, I'm wondering, could I ask you, would you go to Australia? Well, I nearly fell over because it was so unexpected. I'd never been asked something like that before. So I thought for a few seconds and I thought, well, I can hardly say no, but I don't want to say yes. I want to know what's this all about. So I hesitated for a few minutes and I said to myself, oh, this is a trunk call, meaning it was costing a bit of money from Wellington to Auckland. So after a few seconds, I said, oh, well, yes, if you want me to, I suppose yes. And so she told me that Sister Fleur Cordwell, who was a great friend of mine, is a great friend of mine, and who was at St. Therese, wanted to come back to New Zealand. And they thought perhaps I could go over and she could replace me. So I said, yes, all right, yeah, go. And then the next thing was, Mary Shanahan said to me, which was absolutely unheard of, who do you think could replace you in the school where I was very happily working? Well, that was even worse than being asked, would I go to Australia? So I said, oh, I don't quite know, but, I said, now my other great friend, Sister Helen Gilroy, was 1 year out from training college. She was older. She'd done the training, and she was at Christchurch, very happy. And the first year isn't easy, so you look forward to the second year thinking, well, I'm not you anymore, and I can do this and do that. So I said, well, I think Sister Helen Gilroy would be a good one. Well, she hasn't forgiven me yet, I don't think, because she was happy. But so they took me at my word. And Sister Gilroy got a phone call the next day asking would she come to Wellington to replace me. I must say she was a tremendous hit in Wellington. She has still a wonderful following, and she lives with me now in Burradoo. She gets phone calls, she gets letters, she gets parcels from all these, the Italians and others from Island Bay. She's a tremendous letter writer. So she very happily settled in the end in Island Bay. So I was only found out afterwards. I was destined to go to our school at Barraburn in Sydney, attached to Rose Bay. And another good friend from Island Bay days, Sister Diana Hayes, was the, I suppose, principal at Barraburn at the primary school. As much as she wanted to have me, as much as she wanted to have me with her on the staff again, because we'd worked very happily together at Island Bay, she suggested, unbeknown to me, that she didn't think Barraburn would suit me. And now I can say she's right. And another sister was going to Barraburn, it was going to Sadler, and I was going to Barraburn. And I was sent to St. Therese, and the other sister was sent to Barradine. She only stayed a year and went back to New Zealand. So I was the fortunate one. I was told I would have year three, which I hadn't had. I'd had the infant. I was told I would have year three. Sister Betty McMahon, the principal, and she was very hard to pin down to just find out when to come and what to do. So because these new changes had come and I'd been asked directly to go, my superior at Island Bay really didn't have much say in it. But I went to her and I said, I've been told to go to Australia. When do I go? What do I do? And this person said, get a ticket. Get a ticket. And I thought, well, I wonder where I get a ticket from. So I had to go and find out where I got the ticket to come to Australia. I had no idea what date I'd go. And I thought, well, I'm going, I might as well go. So when I rang up to get the ticket, the person at the other end said, I thought, no one who's paying for this, where do I get the money? So I rang and the person at the other end said, do you want first class or economy? Oh, I said, I don't know, what's the difference? So she explained to me. I said, well, I don't know, perhaps I'd better have economy. So I arrived in Australia on the 7th of, about the 7th of January, could have been the 9th, on the same morning that three English girls arrived from England who were coming to give a year's service. I felt I was a bit swallowed up with the three English girls coming from England, but I was very impressed when I saw the convent and I saw the welcome that I was being given. I looked at the area, and then just 2 days before school started, Sister Betty McMahon came to find me and said, oh, there's been a change. You have to have the infants. We've had to rearrange the classes. So I ended up with a kinder over the road behind the church, which I was very happy about. So I got myself over there and I started polishing the floor, and there was a heat wave on. And I was going to work in the classroom next to a Margaret Wright. So we had the two kindergarten classes, and I was extremely happy. I felt, being over there, I was out of the mainstream of the big school, and I was just happily doing what I did best with the little ones. So we worked over there, and I had the kinders for about, I'd say, the first 4 years. And then they thought they would introduce a family grouping. So they were going to have me with kinder first and second. So some of the children I'd had in my first kinder group were then going to be with me again in year two. I think it worked very well on the whole. We had a lot of other schools coming to see us put the program into practice. Margaret Wright was an excellent teacher. She had a great way with her, with the little ones. We did words in colour, and because of my accent, there was no way I was going to teach the I sound to the little ones, because already some parents had commented that they detected a slight accent in their children. So Margaret Wright taught the initial sounds for the words in colour. Now that program didn't last very long, but we had it for about 3 years, I suppose, 3 or 4 years.
Can I just stop you there? Can I take you back just some visual things about what did you think when you arrived in the landscape at Green Valley? What were your first impressions of how the place, did you have any, of how it looked?
Yes, I'd heard stories over the years about the rubbish tip and the buildings, the wonderful Father Muldoon, the spirit. So I knew something of the spirit of the place. And I might just say, when Sister Fleur Caudwell arrived back in New Zealand, she sat down on the end of my bed and she was howling her eyes out. And I said, "Why did you come back? If you were happy and I'm happy, why didn't you stay there?" And she said, "Oh, you'll love it. You'll love it there." Well, my first thought was, when I got there, Fleur was right. Just the spirit of the place. I don't recall my actual... the buildings to me were new, and the classrooms were new. I came from an old school which had just built 2 new classrooms in brick, which were very nice. But I was very impressed with the courtyard and the setup of the school. I didn't feel it was bleak or second rate or anything like that. No, I thought it was quite... I thought it was quite well established, having all the classrooms. I thought it was practical. I know it struck me that it would be very handy to have all classrooms like that, their classrooms, opening outwards onto a courtyard, whereas I'd come from school and they had little classrooms tucked away in various places.
One more question I wanted to ask you, and we'll go back to what you were talking about, just watch your feet kicking the table, that's all. That was what I...
Yeah.
The three English teachers, you obviously recall their names, and maybe some first impressions of what was going on arrival with all this, with them. I know exactly who you're talking about. But just talk to me about their names, and if you could just describe a bit about what was going on.
Well, I can't remember the third one. There was Noreen. Noreen.
There was Brennan Beecham.
Beecham. Noreen. Noreen Beecham.
Keatley or?
Yes, Keatley. I can't remember
the
first
name. Brennan, wasn't it?
And it could be a Brennan.
Sue Keatley.
Sue.
And there was a redhead.
Noreen and a third one.
Beecham, Brennan, Keatley. There was a redhead.
Yeah, one redhead. Well, we also, that morning at the airport, the nuns had just left Rose Bay where we had had our assembly. So they were just released from all those days of listening. And it was early in the morning. It was only about 8 or 9 in the morning. And we arrived within half an hour of each other. It was very close. And Shirley Bartz was there. I think Carmel Dwyer was there. And from the word go, I felt they were given a status as someone's people, very special. They come all the way from England. But they fitted in very well. They needed a good bit of training, I felt. They had a great way with the children. One was a phys ed teacher, and she took over the sports things. I think Shirley Bartz was wonderful with them, and they got them accommodation, and they cared for them. They were good spirits. They were from one of our schools in England. Sister Betty McMahon would have applied to our training college to ask, was there anyone interested in coming for, I think, 2 years, I think they came for. So then they just vanished, and I didn't see them again, of course, till school started. So they disappeared off the thing.
Okay, so do you want me to take you back to where you were?
The clerk, no, that would be...
One thing I was going to ask you with the words in colour, can you talk about, can you say some of them? Not the a, e, I, o, r.
No.
Okay.
I'm not too sure now. I'm not too sure.
Yeah, okay.
Because it was all done in... Now, the downfall of that program was in the kinder, first and second, they had charts and coloured things, and it was all done. But when they went to year three, it was a tremendous down thing. It was very black and white, and I don't know exactly, but I felt that if a child hadn't really understood it, they were going to flounder completely in year three, because if they still hadn't learnt to read by year three, they weren't going to progress. I think Sister Nikki Flippo may have done work with it, with year three, and Helen Taylor. They were the year three teachers. But I think, when I think of those early days, I have two really strong memories of the early days. Betty McMahon was a fantastic principal. She cared for the children, she cared for the parents, and she would go in and fight for any of them. She loved the whole setup. We had, my first thing was, I had, which was a lot in those days, we had big classes, and I think I would have had something like 32, 34 kinders in my class. I had come from a school which was very Italian background, very, very loving families, very supportive of the school, and sisters couldn't do any wrong. My first year, out of all those children, there were only 5 children who had 2 parents living in the home. Now that struck me tremendously, and it made me understand what it meant to these children, that their mothers were more important than perhaps the 2 parents and the other families. The one parent family, were very, very protected, overprotected. And so that is a memory that has stayed very strongly with me. The other very strong memory I have is in my first class, I had this dear little boy, Peter. And he used to come to church. He used to meet me at 8:10, he'd come into church and he'd be there at church. I'd only been there, perhaps a month, and his mother was dying of cancer. And she was in a nursing home, she'd been taken out of the hospital, and Betty used to take me with the 2 youngest, Peter and his brother, to see his mother. And we'd go around there and Betty would talk to the mother. One day, the mother said to Betty, what's going to happen to my children? You know, she had five boys. I'm going to leave them. I don't know what. And Betty said, you have done all you can for your children. You put them aside now. You've made arrangements. People will care for them. But now you've got to think of yourself. You just be at peace. And I was so impressed with her words. And the woman died about a week after that. But it was a lesson to me that Betty just wasn't in the classroom. She was wherever she was needed. And she never hesitated to go off to someone. We had just come out of enclosure. And so this was new to her, going round. One of my most wonderful memories in the 14 years I was there, was the same boy. We were in class one morning. It was the beginning of a new class year. It was February. Beautiful sunny morning. The sun was streaming in. I was over in the main stream at this stage. And for once in my classroom, there was silence and all the children were working. And I was up at the blackboard. And I was writing on the board. And this boy's voice came across the classroom. And he said, "Sister, I love you." And I turned, not one child sniggered, not one child couple looked up. Nobody thought that was strange. So I looked up and looked across and I said, "Peter, I love you too." Not a word. Now to me, that summed up the spirit of St. Therese. That child felt the love. And at his mother's funeral, he had knelt with his class. He hadn't knelt with his family. And he hadn't understood, obviously, really. He had a wonderful aunt and uncle who came and cared for them in the home. But to me, that feeling he had was for the whole environment. He could have said it to Sister Betty McMahon. He could have said it to any of us. But it just struck him in that moment. And I thought, as a 5-year-old, that was pretty powerful. So that's a really wonderful memory I have. I had many, many more such incidences. I had another incident where it was a few years down the track, and a boy had come into the school, a very disturbed little boy, but lovable. But he was disturbed, but I realised perhaps it was how he'd been treated at home. And I had two classes on the mat one morning, knock at the door, and this boy's father came in. I grew to like the father because I felt he couldn't cope. And he came in and he said, "How's he doing?" And I said, "Well, he hasn't been the best." So we talked for a minute. And he said, "I want you to do something for me." He said, "I want you to thrash him." And I said, "Oh, that's not what we do." I said, "If he's naughty on the spot, he'll get a smack around the legs like any other child, but no, he won't be thrashed." And the child was just looking at me, wondering, you know, "Dad said do it." But I've never forgotten that boy either, and I've often wondered. A few years after that, about 4 years or 3 years later, the boy's brother committed suicide. And the father came to me and they asked, would I do the service out at the crematorium for him? Well, I'd never done such a thing. I didn't quite know what the standing was, whether I was allowed to or should do it. But I thought, well, I will do it because they've asked for it. They're grieving. So I went with Father Joe
Camilleri.
And we went out there and did that. And I thought, well, they're only little things. And the boy was never in our school. But they did pick up something of the spirit of how we cared for children.
But how old were you when you hit St. Therese, when you arrived?
33.
So
I must have been 40.
So just, if I can just ask, there was a lot going on. You're coming out of enclosure, you're allowed out of the square, and you're in a new country. Just, how were you placed within yourself at that time?
Freedom. I felt, I had always said to myself when I was in New Zealand that we were 2 years behind Australia, and Australia were 2 years behind America. And when the nuns began to come out of the habit in America, wasn't long before we heard, oh, the nuns in Australia are coming out of the habit. A couple of years later, the odd one appeared in New Zealand, and then a couple. So we were influenced, as we were an international order, we were influenced worldwide, but mostly from America. So when I came to Australia, I still had a veil, and a couple of others did too, but the others were already taking it off. But Father Muldoon insisted that he didn't want us to be any different from the Sisters of Charity in at Liverpool. He was a wonderful, wonderful parish priest. He had tremendous respect for our order, and he cared about us as friends. The habit never worried me. I was happy to stay in it. I was never asked if I wanted to get out of it, but I went along with it. But so in the classroom, we kept the veil. At the weekends, or went out, we could do what we want to do. So about 1980, I was in charge at that time at St. Therese. Father Muldoon came to me and he said, just want to talk to you. He said, I hear, this was again the beginning of a year. He said, I hear the Sisters of Charity are teaching without their veils. I thought, now what was coming after this? He said, you know my feelings, but he said, if you want to take them off, that's okay. He said, but we had Sister Mary Arnold and Sister Mary Smith in the community. They were both 90. One was 93. And he said, I know what the Marys will do. So So he said, I know what the Marys will do. So I got the others and I said, this is the situation. But we either all take them off together or we leave them on. It was the beginning of the school year, about the third day. Okay, we had masses in the morning at 8 o'clock, 8:05. We said, we're going to take them off, we all take them off. So I looked out the window the next morning and crossing the medium strip were the two Marys. Mary Arnold, 93, had no veil on, and Mary Smith, age 90, had her veil on. So the rest of us took our veils off.
If you need a break, just say.
You'll be cutting.
Yes, sir. Don't try and force it. Just if it's just let it happen. If it's we need a break, we just have a break.
Usually once it's past the...
Yeah, it's the way it looks.
Mm. So off we went to church, and Father would have got a surprise to see Mary Arnold with no veil on. He was counting on her. And we went to class. Nobody said anything to anyone. At about 11 o'clock in the morning, I had all my children sitting on the mat. He said, have you had a haircut? And I said, yes. That was the only comment. She knew there was something different, but she couldn't make out what it was. So I'd had a haircut. But then Father Muldoon heard it was a mistake and the charities had not given up their veils. But he said, well, it's up to you now. So we never looked back. But there was that freedom there. We had a very, very nicely built convent for us. And I had lived in institutional places like big convents. And so this was really, I thought, very nice to have a place detached from a boarding school. So I appreciated that. I appreciated but just the family living. That was just ourselves and we could fit in. So there were many things which I found spoke of freedom to me.
Do I have a break? Do I need a break?
I haven't had one of those since last night.
Still going on. On this tape, we've got about 20 minutes left on this one, so it'll come to an end, and
right.
I'll put another one in.
Another thing that I really appreciated was the staff. The staff were very caring for the children. I think we had a few practices which would now not be acceptable in classrooms. For example, for several years, I had every child bring a wooden spoon at the beginning of the year, which they decorated, and we put on a wall. And I only had to get the wooden spoon down from the wall for behaviour to improve. They all knew if their wooden spoon was moved an inch, it wasn't good for the child. But the staff were very, very careful, caring and careful. We helped each other out. Shirley Bartz was a wonderful person in the office. She knew every child by name. She often took the side of the child if you sent them to the office, along with Father Muldoon. If a child was really, really difficult and you sent them to the office and Father Muldoon happened to come along, he'd ask what the problem was. And a bit like, say, Madeleine Sophie, he blamed the teacher. He'd tell the child to go back to class or give them a pat on the head. And so you got no sympathy from Father Muldoon. Another wonderful thing about Father Muldoon was every Christmas he painted the desk. They had very poor equipment and very poor desks, especially in the kinders. And every year he would paint half blue and half pink for the little ones to come and have freshly painted chairs and tables. If you asked him on a Friday, could you have a cupboard or could you have two shelves put up, they would be there on Monday morning. Smelling of paint, but he'd do it straight away. And he would have them in place. Now, in my time at St. Therese, I was fortunate. I was under the three principals. Sister Betty McMahon was the one who set the spirit, who had that feeling of family. Sister Diana Hayes was an educator. And she came and she put in standards for the staff and each class to achieve, and she did a tremendous job. Along came Sister Nancy Fitzgerald, and apart from laughter, she brought a lot of other wonderful things to the school. So I think I was very fortunate to work with the three of them. I used to look at Ted Lowen with the senior students, and I thought he had a wonderful manner with him, how he looked after them and how he cared for them. The adventure playground was so much part of our journey through St. Therese, and I think, as I'm speaking, I'd say freedom still would be a thread that's running through that school. I'm very impressed now when I go back and see what's been achieved. We receive the newsletter from the school, and the only thing that I say every time was I could never teach there now because I couldn't pronounce the names of the students. But I'm very impressed with the standard and the lovely rapport between families and parents and the children and the teachers. And I think that will remain probably as the greatest thing we gave the school in the beginning.
Can you talk a bit about Fete Days and the bottle store?
Yes.
And the kind of lead up to that, kind of involving families in the community.
Well, I had several good ways of getting a bit of money for my classroom. My favourite one was Paddington's birthday. Paddington Bear would have a birthday every year. And the children were allowed to bring a book for Paddington. And I never heard any outright criticism because I felt I had a lot of love from the parents and I loved them. So I never felt there was very much criticism of how we got the children to help us out. But I'd always ask them to bring, and a few parents would say, oh, Paddington's birthday again, but someone would always make a cake. So we'd have a cake as well and they'd bring things. Then we'd have the fundraisers, and I always had the bottle stall where everyone would bring a bottle and we'd put a number on it, and you bought a ticket and you got the corresponding number. We learned early in the piece that we would buy a box of apples and a box of pears. And if we only had 100 bottles and you missed out on the number, you'd get a consolation prize, a pear or an apple. But we soon found out that wasn't any good because we were giving away money, the pear or the thing. But in the end, we had enough bottles for every ticket. It was always the first bottle, it was always the first stall that was finished. And even down here when we've had fates and things, I always have a bottle stall. But I haven't got quite the range, but the most things we got down there were tomato sauce, would be the greatest bottle they would bring as their contribution. Yes, that would be a thing. And Barry Pickup and myself would have, we had a few, not jumble sales, but out at the front gate on a Saturday morning. We'd put all our things up on the driveway and on the thing and encourage people to buy them, buy our goods. It wasn't very successful, I must admit.
With the bottles, can you remember some of the more different bottles?
Whiskey. Someone, or either someone like Neville Bates, or someone would donate a good prize. And that's what they would all aim at. We had to make sure it had to be an adult who could collect that prize. Yes. But they were good fun.
What are some of the other memories you might have of the visuals of the fete? Was it just the school that attended, or did everyone in the, you know, brought outside the school attend the fete days, or was it all sports days, any kind of...
Fete days.
Did you go in any races?
No, I never once.
Oh.
Which was unusual because... And the swimming carnival, the teachers always went in a race, but I never went in because I was always with the little ones. We were sort of in an extra, a different area, but the, including the three from England, they would all swim in the race. Some would. Now, I don't recall the fates being a tremendous fun race. Oh, just before I went there, they had the walk from Merrylands.
Oh, Merrylands. Yes.
Roselands.
Roselands. I remember that one.
They had just had that. That was a walkathon. I missed out on that. I can sort of see candy floss and toffee apples, but I don't really recall. Being in the infant part, we were cut off a good bit from the goings-on of the senior school.
Can I ask you about the social life amongst the staff?
Well, as you say that, my first memory is not the staff, but I'd only been there a very short time, and the parents, led by Margaret Monley, were going on a bus for some great outing. Now, I didn't want to dress up and go. Betty was going, and I think she got Diana Hayes to go with her. And they, under cover of darkness, they all met outside the presbytery and got on a bus, and off they went on an outing. I can't recall where they went, but a lot of hilarity, and Evelyn Jarrett and Carol Dugdale, all these names. I don't recall, they had Tupperware parties. I remember the Tupperware. Avon. Avon rings a bell because they were most generous. The parents there were just so generous. And at Christmas, I would receive not one, but sometimes 10 or more Avon things where they had had these Avon packages they had brought.
What other gifts did you get?
the best gift I ever received was Joe Middleton's grandson went to the Easter show, and he came home and he brought me not one but three show bags. Brought them into the classroom and I put them down beside the desk, just tucked them away. And at going home time, it was teeming with rain, and we were helping the children put their raincoats on. And I picked up one of these show bags and I sort of went to look in it, and little Rachel came running over, pointing her finger at me, and she said, "Greedy guts, teacher." And as she said it, she realized what a terrible thing she had said. So she put hands over her face and looked very guilty. And it wasn't till she had gone, I thought, now, that was silly of me. I should have put those three show bags out in the morning, and they should have all shared them. And I just, you had to be careful that children who didn't give you anything didn't feel guilty. So often when you did receive something, you just put it aside, but it wasn't lost on Rachel. So that became the standard joke, and I'm still called Greedy Guts teacher sometimes.
By who?
By my community and people who know me. So it went down in history. Another memory came then when I thought of that. For example, when I said you didn't want to embarrass other parents, one morning we just started the school year and I was over at the main school, and this parent came with her child. The child came in, she called me out, and I said, "Oh, yes," because she often did call me out. So I was trying to say, "That's okay, she's here. Oh, come out here." And she had a box in her hand. She said, "Look, we didn't see you at Christmas. Here's your Christmas present." Oh, I said, "Oh, thank you very much." This was in the doorway of the classroom. All the kids were watching. And I said, "Thank you very much." She said, "Open it. Open it." And and I opened it, and it was a watch. Well, the oohs and the ahs and the excitement. It was a bit embarrassing. But this family were very, very generous. They are the same family who we were having a come down on wearing the correct uniform. And children were told they had to wear their school shoes and their socks, nothing else, no sneakers, no nothing. And it was July and it was cold and I was doing playground duty. And the grandmother of this family arrived, and she handed me a bag, and in the bag were a pair of Ugg boots, a big pair of Ugg boots. She said, "Put them on." Oh, I said, "I can't." Oh, I said, "They fit me. I'm sure they'll fit me." Thinking, where am I going to wear Ugg boots? "You put them on," she said, "you're on the playground." So I had to put these Ugg boots on. So it became quite a standard joke that I had these Ugg boots. But I found the children were very, very understanding and open-minded. They took it in their stride, that someone might be different, or I mightn't keep the rules, but that was okay. So that was another thing, the Ugg boots.
There might be one other thing about Rock Lobster. I don't know. Is that true that you were all dancing one night?
Not me.
Oh, not you.
I'm not a dancer. I would have been gone. I would have excused myself early.
I think they blamed you. I think I've heard your name. But let's talk about some of those staff. Like, it was a very social mob, wasn't it? I mean, it was like a family.
Very social.
And some laughs. What were some of those? Like, I mean, I know there's a laugh a minute, but...
Well, Carmel Dwyer and I had a lot of little jokes in the classroom that the children appreciated. We had our in-jokes. For example, one morning we turned up, lined up outside our classroom, and I had one red sock on and Carmel had the other one on. So we just lined up, no one said anything, and some children were looking at these socks. They saw Mrs. Dwyer over there with the red sock on. A few parents were looking, but nobody said anything. So we lined up with these red socks on, and we never said anything until some child said, "You've got one sock on, or why has Mrs. Dwyer got one sock on?" And then we'd say, whatever the reason it was, we had put these socks on. But now, we might decide at that particular time we did it because we were doing colours in the classroom and we were doing odds, odd numbers. And so we had an odd sock on each. And we then wanted the children to see if they were allowed to just bring one odd sock or one odd something to follow on. So when Carmel was very ill, I sent her in the mail one red sock. And she kept that red sock. And but they were sort of in-jokes we had where we... I had another thing I used to do when I was growing up. We had no money for anything either, so we could understand. And many a time, if I had to go to cooking class, somebody's mother would give me the potato or give me the jar, what I meant to take, or if I was meant to take a penny or something, someone usually provided, or a teacher would give me something. So when these children were... Lists were always going around. They've got to bring their money for this. Tick it off. They've got to bring their money. Now, I knew the children who they didn't have the money. And it was useless saying to them, you've got to bring it or you can't go tomorrow. So I either tick their names off or I could put the money in for them. Just because the parents mightn't have had the money, but the kids, they didn't understand that. They just knew. You knew the difference between the kids who didn't bother or wouldn't bring it or didn't have their lunch money, but the ones who were genuine, and there were a lot of them. And so many a time I just ticked the list, and this would come round from the office. Had they paid this and that? Oh, yeah, paid. They've all paid, I used to say. They've all paid. And
so you would have, no wonder you felt so comfortable in Green Valley.
Yes. There's something about parents who want to give so much. Like on the first day of school, as you would have known growing up, even with the perspiration running down their neck, the boys would not take their ties off. That was their school uniform. They were proud of it. Cost their mothers a fortune to get it. And they would just not take it off. And then I used to hear these terrible stories of the boys going off to the brothers. Shirley's son being strapped for 3 weeks in a row until another child told his mother he's getting the strap every week because he hasn't got a blazer. And when Shirley said, but why didn't you tell me? He said, well, I haven't got a blazer. We can't get a blazer till next month. So why tell you? So things like that, I found terribly hard to accept that this is how life was in other schools.
We're just going to run out of space here, so I'm going to, we'll just keep talking until it actually runs out. How are you going?
Not too badly. Not
Is there a, I mean, I think there's probably a little bit more you can talk about. That was a beautiful story. There were some beautiful stories in that. Were you the principal of St. Therese?
No. No, I was never principal. I was deputy most of the time. They kept changing the titles at the education office. While Sister McMahon was there, I was deputy or senior teacher, whatever you call them. And then when she left and Sister Hayes came along, I found it wasn't in either of our interests to be in that role. She's a very good friend of mine, so I resigned from that role. Sister Nancy Fitzgerald came along and she said, well, I won't be principal unless you're my deputy. And I said, but I was, and I resigned. She said, well, apply for the job. So I had only been appointed before that, but I applied for the job, and Father Muldoon was on the committee down at Hurstville.
So this is a continuation of the interview with Joy Belt on the 22nd of July, and you were describing the interview.
Going down to Hurstville to apply for the job of deputy principal. We went down to Hurstville, and Nancy and I were waiting outside, and a couple of people had been through for interviews, and then I was called forth, and they were very mystified as to why, if I had been deputy principal, why was I applying for the job. So I explained that Nancy really wanted me to be her deputy. There'd been conflict of interest in the other arrangement, and I felt it was better not to be in that role. I thought I could be of more help out of the role than in. So they put me through the hoops, and then one of the panel said to me, if you had a problem in your school, what would you do about it? And I said, I'd ring the CEO. I presume you would be able to handle it. Well, they all just sat and looked at me and said, oh, that was all, thank you. So I went out, and away we went. So Nancy and I went off to the pictures, and we left Father Muldoon. So anyway, I was appointed once again to be a deputy principal. Nancy was a wonderful principal. In her time, we seemed to have had more break-ins than we had in the other. Whether our young children had grown old enough to start breaking into the canteen, I don't know. But some of our old boys were caught. And we had several occasions where we either caught people in the act or we found the remains of a break-in. And Nancy took it all in a stride. And she used to say, there was one very definite example of how she coped. Her manner was saying, if it makes the other person happy, I don't mind. I'll go along with it. So we had this parent who, it was a Friday, and she was up in arms about something that had happened with one of her children in the school. And she had come in, she came in to see us in the convent, and she had brought her youngest boy with her, and she pulled down his pants, and the strap marks on that boy's bottom were unbelievable. Unbelievable that a five-year-old boy, and the boy was not to blame. And so this mother was all up and armed and saying she had belted him because he had done this and done that. Now, Nancy was marvellous, and she listened to the woman, and she said, well, it's Friday, I can't do anything else about it, but on Monday. So off went the woman, And Angie said, I can't leave it till Monday. I can't. I've got to go and see this other person because she's suffering. And she's treated that child like that out of anger at herself and everyone else. And if we can make her feel better, doesn't matter. I'll go and do it. Even though I have to go and apologise to this other person. And she did. She went off, dealt with this other situation, came back, got in touch with this one, brought her down, and really coped with that beautifully. Now, most people have said, look, it's the weekend. I'll see you on Monday. But no, she did. That's what she did. And she did a couple of things like that where she used to say, it doesn't matter. I don't mind what they say to me or what happens, as long as they're happy. She used to say the same with the children. And there was one incident where, a most unusual incident, as far as I knew in my day, it was the only incident. Four girls were caught at 4 o'clock smoking in the toilets. And I only happened to come across and saw three girls crying in a corner. And I saw one mother striding across the playground with the other child. So I got out of the way at the moment because I thought, it's not to do with me, but there'll be trouble here. And so Nancy came round the corner with whoever had caught them. And this mother who was striding across the playground with her child said to Nancy, what's the big deal? Weren't you ever caught behind the shed smoking, or didn't you do something? Why turn this into a big drama when it's really not a big drama? It was a silly thing for them to do. Two of them suffer from asthma. But don't make them feel they've committed a tremendous crime. And Nancy said to me, you know, she was right. I handled that badly. So she always learnt. And I've often thought of that incident. What's the big drama? Didn't you do something like that when you were... Well, Nancy probably did many things. And so if you keep your dramas for the serious things...
For the stage.
Yes. There'd be a few less traumas. Or if it was handled differently. So that's another incident I remember of Nancy. How she said, I learnt from that.
With your teaching, because everyone talks about you as this great teacher, what do you feel like, you know, was important for you that you, I mean, it sounds like you gave the school an enormous amount, but what were important, what did you impart to the school? What do you feel was your, not legacy so much, or maybe?
That I love them, and I knew they loved me. And one of the main decisions for leaving, so many parents, I couldn't tell you how many parents came and spoke to me of their terrible memories of being taught by nuns. You wouldn't believe some of the stories they would tell me. I was never taught by nuns myself. I had a family very close to me who were taught by nuns, and they certainly never ever, and they were Sacred Heart nuns, they never ever told me stories, horrifying stories of how they'd been treated. The worst I ever heard was, one person told me she stole a tennis ball from a child's desk and said it was hers, and which I think was a terrible punishment. They were getting ready for First Communion, and she was made to wait a year for a First Communion because she told a lie and stole it. I think that was terrible. But I never ever heard any stories of ill treatment. But parents told me some terrible stories of how they were treated, of either being smacked or hit or deprived of things, or their parents being spoken ill of because they didn't have what was necessary, that during about 1984, 85, I was giving a lot of thought to this, and I'm a great believer in dreams. And Nancy and I used to go to dream sessions every Tuesday night up the mountains. And my dreams were a group of 17 of us under a very skilled person. My dreams were beginning to be about classrooms with cobwebs. A famous one where I'd been in trouble and someone offered me a cup of tea and I never got the cup of tea. Another time I never got the cup of tea. Anyway, I could go on forever on that, but I'll leave that. And so when I was going to these sessions, it became quite obvious that it was time I re-looked at my time in the classroom. The classroom had cobwebs. And there was one particular dream, which I won't go into, but it was important, of me finding a person trying to put a pair of knickers on a dog. There were three pairs of knickers hanging on the line. Blue, white, and blue, white, and pink. Now, those colours stand for, I think she said the blue was intellectual, the pink was emotional, and the white was me, spiritual, trying to develop something for myself. And those three things were strung up for me to choose, to look at. So we had all these discussions, and I was mindful of the stories these parents had told me. And I came to the conclusion that I did not want ever to have a child remember me for having hurt them or damaged them in any way. And I wanted to leave while I still love them and they love me. So I took my notebook of dreams and I went along to see our provincial, who fortunately also believed in dream work. And she said, "You've got your dreams, it says everything. What do you want to do? If you come out of the classroom, what would you look at doing?" And I said, "I'd like to go to Kerevere Park and work there." So that's how I came to come out of the classroom. I still have children who keep in touch with me. The most consistent one, a little girl, Brooke, who, when she was in my class, she was in my, could have been my last class at St. Therese, one of my last, and she was a little girl who, whenever you spoke to an adult, she was between you. You say, "Brooke, would you go away?" Whenever you wanted anything, Brooke would be there. And you say, "Brooke, just go away." She has never missed Easter, my birthday, or Christmas, sending me a card or a letter. I was in the States. I still got those cards and the letters. We send each other birthday cards, Easter cards, and Christmas cards. She's now a very beautiful 28-year-old. She was at the reunion down there. Now, I don't know what it was there. It wasn't mutual attraction. But for some reason, so to me, she is a child of St. Therese. And her birthday is on the Feast of the Little Flower. So that's that. Now, the other one I have is another Therese, who she was in my first class at St. Therese. And she was in a difficult situation because her mother was very, very deaf. She was a very intelligent little girl. She knew her mother didn't understand her, and I had a lot to do with both of them, convincing her mother to get hearing aids, trying to make the child understand, you know, what was going on. Now, I babysat that child for nearly 4 years, two nights a week. I used to go over on a Tuesday and a Thursday night to allow the mother to go to Parents Without Partners, and she went one night to Ashcroft to do a course, whether it be guitar or just something for herself. Now, we have stayed in touch. I'm godmother to her eldest boy. I'm close to all of them. And as her mother also had a lot to do with the school, with the goats and the playground and looking after the place. So she has stayed as part of the St. Therese story.
So simply love, the motto,
was chosen before I went there, but it says it all.
Yeah, it does. Mm. You certainly all kind of lived by it, didn't you?
Yes. Yes.
Can you, like that spirituality, can you talk a bit about that general in goodwill in the convent, like the spiritual, like, I don't know whether I'm...
In the school or in the community?
Well, just because simply love was lived.
Mm. Yes, as I said, it was my first experience of living in a convent, built as a convent, and for a family. So it was simple. We had people coming in and out. Wendy Hand and her mother Ruby. Ruby was a very dear friend of mine. And that was a sorrow for all of us. Now, after Wendy died, Ruby used to take Wendy to dancing every Saturday at 1 o'clock. Now, the only day she couldn't cope with was Saturdays. So she used to come down to us. And we started playing canasta. All of us except one. One person who joined us later resented somebody coming into the community. And she used to say, she shouldn't be in here. And we used to say, well, this is our home. She's part of us. She's got a great sorrow. And if we can do something to help her, we think we should. But she could not understand, just because she had come from an institutional thing. And it's interesting, and I only mentioned this a week ago, some people's birthdays you never remember. This particular person's birthday, every year I say to myself, oh, it's her birthday. She's long dead now. But we were having a community meeting at some stage while she was in the community. And out of the blue, there would have been seven of us, say, in the circle. Out of the blue, this person said, I have never felt loved. Well, I was astounded. Now, we had a facilitator. And, you know, you're told, if people say something, they say it. You're not meant to interact or criticize or agree or do anything. It's their statement. Anyway, she said this. She said, I have never felt loved. Oh, I couldn't help it. I said, I love you. I couldn't believe. And I had never forgotten it. So there, that could tie up with that. That whole thing, which I'd never realized before. She couldn't cope with that feeling of, she might have felt more out of it. She might have felt we were giving more love to that person, but she had never expressed needs herself before then. So Ruby came to us, for months and months. And on Christmas Eve, Peter and Ruby used to come, and the boys would come to the convent after midnight mass and stay with us for a couple of hours because they never wanted to go home. So we were there for them, and just gradually, and then to lose Ruby was a great personal sorrow to me. I was in New Zealand when she died. So we lost Father Muldoon and Ruby at the same time, and Maria Angela, who was up here. But I would say that love, we would not have consciously in the community set out to say we must love, or let's not forget the motto. We've got to love. We just did it. And it rubbed off on others.
How important do you think Betty's example, like from the word go?
Oh, it was crucial. The school would not have been the school it is today without her influence. Would be true of any foundress. And if I went in, I might stress on them generosity and go from there. But because they made it that, and she's a very generous person, so I think love and generosity go together. And I think the Sacred Heart, even though we didn't connect it as such, we did it as St. Therese, the Sacred Heart was love. My love poured out for you. Well, that's exactly what happened with the children. It was poured out for them. So certainly Betty being the foundress, she set the seal on the direction, but it has gone along in leaps and bounds. And I think a tremendous link there today is Jenny Hartley. She's still in the school. She was the first lay teacher Betty employed. She was married there. She has lived through it with her boys. The associates, our associates of the Sacred Heart, she was in that, or is in that, under Nancy Fitzgerald. And when the nuns left St. Therese, Jenny Hartley kept the associates going there. So there's always that tremendous link. And I think we've got very strong links if you start to look at them with the children and the others. I mean, there's some parents I mightn't see for a long, long time. But it's sad that when we go there now, we go for funerals. Nancy Morrissey's farewell, we couldn't go to either, which was a pity, the Catholic Club or the Mass. And there are less and less of us there. And I think one of them had a very good comment to make as we move on into our senior years. The people in the valley stayed there. Some bought their homes. Some improved their homes. Some, after their children grew up and moved out, they have moved out. And so we didn't need to stay there because that bond is so strong. No matter where we go, it's there. So now we're moving on into a different stage. Betty's gone on her sabbatical. We don't know what the future holds. But I think there will always be, and because the staff, especially the principals, are so wonderful in preserving the memory of the Sisters of the Sacred Heart, will be remembered there long after we're gone. Oh, there we are.